Domestic violence is common, serious, and rarely discussed. When we ask how we can improve the welfare of children and families, we talk about health, education, poverty, substance abuse, and crime. And it's altogether right that we do. But less often, hardly ever, do we acknowledge the role that family violence plays in the problems that plague New Mexico. My goal today is to tell you how New Mexico is affected by family violence, what we are doing to change that, and what's next. A few points I'd like to make before getting started. The first is that most victims, 70%, never go anyplace at all for help. Fewer than one half ever call the police, and only 5 to 7% ever enter a shelter. That means an enormous number of people are suffering the effects of violence and abuse, and no one is doing anything at all. That needs to change. Two. Shelters and our domestic violence programs around the state are critical, life-saving measures. As my colleagues would tell you, and as a national study found, people entering shelters have many serious, long-standing problems, and the work of shelters is getting much harder. It's more important than ever, but it's much harder. Three, most of the people who commit domestic violence are not monsters. Some are, and we need to deal more effectively and preemptively with them. But most are just repeating what they've learned as children, and would do something else if they knew what and how. And last, domestic violence is more than a black eye. It's insidious, it's subtle, it's often invisible, and people who have suffered from it rarely identify themselves as victims. They would never, for example, check yes in a box on a survey that asks whether they are, and all of that further complicates our efforts. So, let me give you a few numbers so we get kind of a basis in terms of what we're talking about. A 2005 survey in New Mexico found that 1 in 3 women and 1 in 7 men will be victims of domestic violence. Compared to national statistics, it seems similar, if not the same, although some national statistics indicate 1 in 4 people, others say 1 in 2, but I'm not going to load you up on stats. Suffice it to say that there is no research that I know of to suggest that domestic violence is anything but a common and serious problem. The question then is, what does all of that mean? What are the implications? And I'm going to start with a well-known study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences, and many of you may already have heard of it. What they found was that exposure as a child to physical and emotional abuse and neglect led to a lifetime of illness, misery, and for some, even an early death, dying on average 20 years before their counterparts without such exposures. One researcher even called it the leading determinant of the health and well-being of our nation. And yet, when these researchers tried to get media coverage for these findings, they were unable to do so. That's hard to understand, given what they found, which was this. Exposure to trauma, to emotional and physical abuse and neglect, appears to be correlated with the development of cancer, heart attack, diabetes, stroke, substance abuse, asthma and other lung disorders, obesity, mental illness, depression, suicide, and more. And those are just illnesses. Domestic violence is also highly connected to homelessness. Almost 100% of homeless women and children in this country are homeless because of domestic violence. Jaime Tamez, the former director of Cuidando in Albuquerque, attended a press conference held by our coalition last year, in which he mentioned that at least 75% of his homeless child clients had come from domestic violence homes. He later revised his figure upward to 100%. If all this research is correct, then family violence, defined broadly, is at the root of all of the problems I just listed. These conditions are known to be the symptoms of trauma, but symptoms are not causes. Still, we are well-intentioned and we don't want people to suffer, and so we treat the symptoms, even if we leave intact the cause. It's like giving an aspirin for the plague. It lowers the fever, reduces the immediate danger. People may feel better, but the disease is still there, and it still spreads. So as a society, we try to reform education so kids will get good jobs and not grow up to be impoverished. We try to get kids to exercise more and eat more broccoli and fewer donuts so that they don't become diabetic. We educate them about the dangers of alcohol and substance abuse. But again, these are the symptoms and not the causes. I want to say something about poverty. People often ask me whether poverty causes domestic violence. There are certainly connections between poverty and family violence, but less often do they ask the more meaningful question, which is, does domestic violence cause poverty? Because those connections exist too. How? There are lots of ways, as we can imagine, that domestic violence and poverty are connected. But one major symptom of exposure to trauma is hopelessness. People who are hopeless do not decide to knuckle down and study hard so that they can get to a good school and maybe someday become an astronaut. They drop out. What's the use anyway? They numb themselves. They take drugs and use alcohol. They run away. They get victimized repeatedly by strangers, by friends, by family. They become homeless. They get pregnant. They commit crimes. And eventually they suffer the effects I just named. None of that, so far as I'm concerned, is the roadmap to prosperity. In fact, it goes in the other direction. While there may be a few who are lucky enough or resilient enough to overcome, most won't. And they'll go on to teach what they've learned to their kids, who will teach it to their kids, and so on. Let me say something about crime. We often describe domestic violence as a crime that occurs behind closed doors, in private. That's mostly true. But it doesn't stay behind closed doors. It doesn't stay private. It spills over. Our prisons are full of people who've committed violent crimes who came from violent homes. Crime begets crime. Last fall, we brought a woman named Mildred Muhammad to a conference we were holding. Mildred is the wife, she takes great pains to say she is the ex-wife, of John Muhammad, known as the DC Sniper. John Muhammad and his stepson, then a minor, shot and killed at random at least 10 people in the Washington, D.C. area. People presumably getting a newspaper, buying coffee, putting gas in the car. Now, John told his wife, Mildred, that he was going to kill her, and he even had a plan. He told her he was going to make it look random. She would be one of many killed, and so no one would suspect him. Mildred was understandably terrorized. John stalked her. She stayed in shelters around the country. He still kidnapped their children. And John was what we would call a domestic violence offender. But that's not all he was. John was also a victim of child abuse, who grew up to be a man ultimately executed by the state of Virginia. That was his adverse effect. His son, a minor, jailed for life. His other kids, adversely affected for sure, the children of someone who committed mass murder, someone who was ultimately executed, and God knows what adversity the families of those killed endured. According to Mildred, the media never covered those aspects, either John's domestic abuse or his abuse as a child. I'll talk to you a little bit about programs for people who are arrested, convicted, or who use domestic violence. It may go without saying that we won't address violence or its effects unless and until we persuade the people who use it to stop. I worked for years as a counselor in domestic violence programs, and while some of the people that I worked with are unquestionably beyond redemption, many are not. What matters to them? First, the discovery that there is something other than abuse available to them. Two, that their kids are really suffering. And three, most of all, that it's not too late. We could say with conviction to people, if you stop now, not only will you stop the damage to your children, you may well reverse it. There's something about admitting to a problem and then changing that teaches children something really good and contributes to the health and well-being in their lives. But all of this is just my word. The challenge for us as a field is to prove it, to prove that these programs are effective. And that's hard because there's such a wide variation in how they are implemented. For example, you may have three PhDs in Boston providing these groups, and in a small town, you might have one person who works full-time at the Best Buy who does a group on Tuesday evenings. The problem is that researchers cannot measure because there's too much of a difference. So what are we doing? First, we as a state have spent the last 2 years developing standards, a basis, some guidelines from which our programs can operate so that they are on the same page. Two, we're offering training online and through a group of trainers that we've recruited from around the state. That way, the person who works at Best Buy can do just as good a work as the three PhDs from Boston. And finally, I am on a national committee charged with looking at the effectiveness and then communicating that broadly, and I can bring what I'm learning on that committee home to all of us. Next, I mentioned that most victims never tell anyone about the abuse, and they never seek help. I also said that needs to change, but how? Here in New Mexico, we have adopted a model. It's cutting edge. It's also controversial about how to get help to people who need it. Whether someone who is abused is staying in an abusive relationship or not, whether they're identifying themselves as victims or not, we are changing our approach, we're changing the way we talk about things, and we're trying to change our services so that those people will find a place to go. New Mexico is actually leading the way. Last year, we had a two-day training in Albuquerque. We had another half-day training following that. And this past June, we recruited 9 people from all around the state, and we took them to Nevada, where we were holding a training. They have now become trainers, and they can take this information back to their own communities. It's not a panacea, but it's a start. Last, I mentioned that our shelters are overwhelmed by the sheer numbers of people they see and the kinds of problems that they bring. They see the worst cases, people with substance abuse, mental illness, people in extreme danger. I have a number of friends who are psychologists and psychiatrists, and they tell me that the problems that shelter clients bring are ones that even they feel helpless to deal with. And in their practices, they try to take only a few of those people because it's so hard. But our programs don't see just a few people. They might see 5, 10, 20. In fact, everyone they see is likely to have those kinds of serious problems. And they don't see them for 50 minutes. They see them every day. They live with them. They drive them to the doctor. They get up in the middle of the night when the kids are having nightmares. They talk over and over about their experiences, and they absorb all of it as if it had happened to them. One thing we know is that trauma affects the brain. But not only does it affect the brain of people who experience it directly, it affects the brains of those people who hear about it. The staff who work in these shelters are experiencing that trauma on a daily basis and are suffering the same kinds of effects as if it had happened to them directly. Our shelter staff are bearing the brunt of the work that needs to be done here in New Mexico, and they are largely doing it alone. So what are we doing? This past year, we became the recipient. We are one of 3 states chosen to be a part of a 5-year federally funded project. We call it TIP, Trauma-Informed Practices Project. As part of this grant, national leaders from all over the country came to Santa Fe for 2 days to help us plan our approach. They brought experts in children, substance abuse, mental illness, organizational health, and data collection. The federal government has begun to require that states who receive Family Violence Prevention and Service Act money, such as New Mexico does, become trauma-informed. That means that states must demonstrate an understanding of everything I just described, as well as a willingness to implement that. My colleagues around the country, some of them, were mortified because they were not prepared. But in New Mexico, we were. Last, I want to mention something more about kids. Last March, March 4th, 2011, was declared for Child Domestic Violence Lasts a Lifetime Day by the Senate. Senate Memorial 59 outlined the problems that children face, the effects on children of violence, and what can be done to change that. We have forged unprecedented collaborations. In the last 2 years alone, we've held 3 major summits. We worked with Head Start, CYFD, Department of Health, Home Visitors, Corinne Wolf Children's Law Center, the Children's Court Improvement Commission, and more. We've held management trainings in cooperation with Head Start so that the staff who work in our respective programs and who hear these stories every day do not suffer the trauma associated with it. And we have a major Violence Against Women Act funded grant to train Head Start workers around the state. That's not all we're doing. It's just a sample. But we are moving ahead. In closing, I want to say this. We can't continue as we have. Almost everything that matters to us is challenged by the presence of family violence. Everything we care about is on the line. And yet, we're making really just the minimum payment on our credit cards. We're working hard, but we're not progressing. Interest is like a symptom, but the real cause is the debt, and we're not working on it the way that we should. The domestic violence community would like to be part of the solution. We know something about how family violence contributes to the problems that New Mexico faces, and we know what we can do to change that. We would like to develop some ambitious goals and objectives that would really move us forward, and we'd like to do it in a collaborative way. Last, I want to mention that I went to a domestic violence educational event some time back, and when I walked into the room, what I saw was a real living example of everything that I've just said today. There were people in the room who had oxygen tanks, wearing patches on their eyes because they'd lost their eyesight due to diabetes, people using canes. There was a lot of illness and misery in that room. And what they wanted to talk about was the trauma that they endured as children and how it affected them. But that's not all that they wanted to talk about. They also wanted to talk about how they had learned to inflict that same trauma on their families in a never-ending cycle. They were courageous and willing to talk, and that is an important first step. And I want to thank you all for allowing me to talk about this issue and for giving me this time.